Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted outside and in the clerk's office. This morning, the court has three causes which will be submitted by oral argument. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Bonnie Gail Weirich, individually and as managing conservator for Charles Jacob Weirich and Jennifer Gail Weirich versus Opal Weirich from Bexar County. Howson D. Williams versus Sherry Yvonne Patton from Brazoria County and Holt Atherton Industries Incorporated versus Roy Heine and wife from Goliad County. In each of these causes, the petitioners and respondents will be given 15 minutes to present oral argument. The petitioners may, by designation with the marshal, save back whatever amount of time petitioners wish for rebuttal argument. Court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause, but we will complete these oral arguments before the lunch break. Counsel in the second and third causes may leave the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but we do ask that you be here when it is time to call your cause for argument. These arguments are being recorded by the court for its convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Weirich versus Weirich.
May it please the court, Mr. John Nichols and Ms. Lynn Kerger will present argument for petitioners. Ms. Kerger will open. The petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for the vote.
May it please the court. My name is Lynn Kerger, and I'm here today representing the petitioner, Bonnie Weirich Edwards, and her children, Jake and Jenny Weirich. Also present are the attorneys who argued this case and in trial. Larry Doherty is sitting in the audience, and John Nichols, who will be handling rebuttal today. The first four points of error upon which writ was granted dealt with notice provisions contained in the Texas Family Code, Chapter 36. For the purposes of our argument here today, I have divided those four points into two questions. The first point being whether Bonnie should be denied recovery under Chapter 36 of the Family Code because Opal, the grandmother, did not receive written notice 30 days prior to the filing of the lawsuit. This question involves the application of Section 3607 of the Texas Family Code. In this case, the respondent, Opal, is claiming that under Section 3607A that Bonnie should be denied recovery because, without doubt, she did not receive, it has been stipulated, she did not receive written notice by a certified mail return receipt requested 30 days prior to the filing of this lawsuit. In response, Bonnie argues that the statute did not become effective until September the 1st, 1983. This lawsuit was filed March the 3rd, 1982, 19 months prior to the enactment of the statute, and there was no way for her to comply with requirements that were not even in existence at the time. Secondly, we argue that under 3607D, the code provides notice need not be given to persons aiding or assisting in conduct for which a cause of action is authorized under this section. The jury found that Opal had aided and assisted in conduct which is a violation under Section 3602A. Expressly then, notice never needed to be given to Opal Weirich prior to the filing of this suit. The case of Smith v. Smith, which is the only other case that has been taken up on appeal since the passage of this provision of the code, had a very similar problem, in which case the Houston court held that there was no need to provide notice. Our third argument under this point is that Opal had actual notice in the pleadings of the charges against her since March the 3rd of 1982. She never cured the condition. The purpose of notice in this case is clearly to have a chance to return the children to the family. The legislative history tells us, in this particular case, that 3607 was not part of this original bill. None of the notice provisions were there, nor was Section 3604(2), which is the affirmative defense that after receiving notice of violation, a person who returns the children will then be able to offer that as an affirmative defense. It is our position that combining these two provisions shows that the legislature intended to make this be a cure provision. In any case, Opal knew from March of 1982 that she was being charged with interference with child custody, and she had nearly 7 years to return the children and did not do so. So to impose a technical requirement of notice upon her, upon Bonnie at this point in time.
She had the ability to return the children?
She testified throughout trial that she did not have the ability, that she did not know where they were.
But do you have evidence to the contrary?
Yes, yes, Justice, we do.
There was evidence to the contrary in the trial. What was that?
We believe that the evidence showed and the jury found that she did have contact with her son on at least 4 occasions, probably 5, that she testified to herself. And at each of those occasions, certainly in those times, she had a chance to cure the condition because the code also provides that one can reveal the whereabouts, not conceal the whereabouts of the children.
So her mistake then was not in revealing the whereabouts, not in actually not returning the children, but because she knew where they were and did not reveal it?
That's correct. That's our position.
Was that the allegation?
That was the allegation. As to the period of time after they were taken, there's a taking time that was in February of 1982 when the children were abducted. Following that, there is retaining. The children were with their father. But on 4 different visits, possibly 5 visits that she testified to in Texas, the children were with the father on 2 of those occasions. And she, Opal, had answered affirmatively in a March 11, 1982 hearing that if she did know where the children were, that she would contact the court and Bonnie's counsel and tell them the whereabouts of the children.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Isn't the chief issue in this case is whether or not we recognize in Texas an independent cause of action for the negligent infliction of emotional distress in the context of this case? Isn't that the chief issue, and how does Reagan v. Vaughn, the writing of this court just the last couple of weeks, impact on this issue?
Yes, that is a major issue. I would like to address that in 2 ways. First of all, as to whether the cause of action can exist in a child abduction case, which was the holding of the Fourth Court of Appeals. The relevant sections of the code are Section 3603 and 3606. 3603 provides a remedy only to the petitioner, in this case, Bonnie. A petitioner under the code is allowed recovery for the expenses in locating the children, attorney's fees, and the value of their own mental suffering and anguish. The children are not expressly, no damages are listed for children. However, under 3606, the provision is made that any other person, that would be Bonnie, including children, that would be Jake and Jenny, may bring any other remedy, either civil or criminal, to have redress for their wrongs. So I believe that if we can get past that place, that we do have a provision for a common law remedy of negligent infliction of mental anguish. As to the second part of your question, as to reconciling it with Reagan v. Vaughn, it is our position that in Reagan v. Vaughn, that would be a case where mental anguish was denied. My interpretation of that opinion was it was denied because of the bystander or the contemporaneous perception rule. And these torts, the mental anguish tort or emotional distress or emotional trauma, I believe can be divided into sort of 2 types of mental anguish claims. One are indirect claims where the plaintiff is claiming that they have mental anguish that has been induced by apprehension of injury to a third-party victim. In those cases, the court has held that there must be a contemporaneous perception of the event.
Isn't the difference between, not that, but the difference in the cleavage comes by, there's a difference between intentional infliction of emotional stress and a negligent infliction of emotional stress. Isn't that the real dividing line?
That would be another dividing line, and that would be whether or not one has a specific intent to do the injury.
How can you have a negligent kidnapping? Or a negligent conspiracy to kidnap? Doesn't the whole nature of the abduction scenario import intent?
Yes, Mr. Tech, I believe so. The abduction itself is an intentional act.
And participating in it is intentional.
And participating in it.
Opal didn't negligently do anything, did she?
Our position is that the intent was to ensure the father, Noel, continuing exclusive relationship with the children. But out of that body of facts, several causes of action can arise. They did not intend to cause mental anguish to Bonnie or to the children.
They
it was a natural, it should have been a risk that was foreseen. The danger was apparent. One would certainly foresee that if you kidnap a woman's children, both the mother and the child will suffer mental anguish. And there was testimony at trial that this is called by the psychologist psychological amputation, which causes extreme mental anguish.
Well, could you ever have circumstances like these in which the suffering caused to the mother was unforeseeable or unintended?
I don't believe so. I think that in the normal context of human affairs and in relations of family, that taking a woman's children for 7 years where she doesn't know if they're alive or dead and doesn't have any knowledge of what's happening to them, it's inherent in the nature of the tort in this particular case.
It's intentional, isn't it? I mean, how can it be negligent? That's
the taking of the children was intentional. While we cannot go into respondent's state of mind, I'm not sure that they took the children so that they could make the mother suffer.
That
there was no
intention. It sounds to me like swinging my fist at you is intentional, then the fact that it hit you and caused you pain is negligent. You really parse it that fine?
I would say that the battery that you're speaking of is one of the class of the intentional torts that we presume intent in those. If in fact there was a post-traumatic stress disorder that arose from that event, that would have been a negligent act because you as the actor intended to hit. You may not have intended for this person to end up in a mental ward because of that act.
Counsel? We're talking about the evidence with Justice Hightower a few moments ago. As I recall, the evidence before the jury was that a few days before the children were abducted, Opal bought a lot of clothes for them. And that just, 3 or 4 days before the children were abducted, she co-signed a $4,000 note for the abducting father. That during the course of 7 years of abduction, the children were brought to visit her on several occasions, brought into her home, and she had telephone contact on a fairly regular basis with the abducted father. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And whether or not they intended to do damage to the mother, to inflict any harm on her. They totally disregarded whether if it was obvious that they intended to do it to get at her rather than to keep the children for the father. That might be in some evidence of an intentional tort on her. But whether or not they did, that was the result. It was an obvious result, a predictable result, a fairly foreseeable result. So at the very least, there's a reckless disregard for the effect on her, isn't there?
That would be my position.
Gross negligence.
Would be reckless disregard in any case.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Don Kochman will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Don Kothman. I'm with the law firm of Hearn, Connolly, Livingston, and Holcomb. I represent the respondent, Opal Wyrick. While I do not claim to be a particularly quick study, I have noticed during the past months and weeks this court has addressed some attention to causes of action that relate to the question of negligent infliction of emotional distress. That is one of the key issues addressed by the Court of Appeals in this case and is one of the key issues pending before this court. I will take some time this morning and respectfully submit to this court that in the narrow context of a case for interference with child custody, this state does not recognize a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress, and likewise does not recognize a cause of action for negligent interference with a family relationship.
Counsel, could you distinguish for me 36.03, the damage section of the Family Code, subparagraph 5, which does provide for the value of mental suffering and anguish?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Under damages that this chapter may include, it says the value of mental suffering and anguish incurred by the petitioner because of a violation of the court order.
Yes, sir. That is entirely consistent with the common law action which has been previously recognized by this court. It is also entirely consistent with what the legislature did in following this court's opinion and enacting the general provisions of Section 700 of the Restatement of Torts. One of the reasons that I would respectfully submit to this court that there is no independent cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress in a child abduction case is that that issue, that concern, has already been addressed both under the common law and by the legislature. This is not one of those situations where the legislature has failed or refused to act. In this particular instance, the legislature, recognizing the value of the family and recognizing that child abduction can cause mental distress, has directly addressed that question. Therefore, it allows recovery upon appropriate proof of mental anguish. That is really no different than the previous law recognized by this court in Silcott versus Oglesby. I recognize that the question of interference with child custody perhaps goes back to the Redeker decision. But in Silcott versus Oglesby, this court specifically recognized it under the common law of this state. And in that opinion, this court characterized it as a willful and intentional interference. And because it was a willful and intentional interference, this court also recognized, as does Section 700 of the Restatement of Torts, that one of the things that a parent can recover is mental anguish. My point is, there is no need to create a new cause of action so that a parent whose children have been abducted can recover mental anguish. The mechanism is already there.
Do you agree that a cause of action lay under the statutory change in 1988 or whatever it was?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the part.
Can the plaintiffs in this case take advantage of the change in the statute to bring a statutory cause of action?
Under the court's opinion in Silcott versus Oglesby, I think that the plaintiff can bring a lawsuit under Chapter 36 of the Family Code.
Even though events took place before the change in the statute.
I think that's correct. And the basis for that is that I do not see a great deal of difference between Section 700 of the Restatement and Chapter 36, with one exception, and that is Chapter 36 of the Family Code provides certain mechanisms designed to perhaps avoid confrontations in the courtroom, and one of those mechanisms is the notice provision.
And that's your complaint regards to statutory action?
That is correct. And, well, it's one of our complaints. 36.02 is the cause of action for directly taking, retaining, or concealing a child in violation of a court order. Section 36.07 specifically provides that you must give written notice to an individual if that is what you are claiming that they did. If
well, is it correct that they filed a lawsuit 19 months before that statute was enacted?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And is it your contention to this court that they should have waited 19 months and then applied, filed under a statute that hadn't been passed when they filed their lawsuit?
That's pretty close to it, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. This case was filed in 1982. The statute was passed some 19 months later, as you correctly pointed out. The things that my client was accused of was interference with child custody under the common law, Section 700 of the Restatement, and negligent and intentional interference with child, negligent and intentional infliction of mental anguish. The case rocked along for a number of years. The case was set for trial on December 5 of 1988 by order of the San Antonio District Court. On November 28...
Was that after the children had been returned to the mother?
No, sir. The children were not found until after the case was tried. On November 28th of 1988, within 7 days of trial, the plaintiff, for the first time, did several things. They amended their petition to allege roughly 17 causes of action, including an action for spoliation and a number of other things, which I had to look up because I didn't know what spoliation was.
Spoliation of documents?
Yes, sir. One of the other things that they did for the first time when they amended in November of 1988, within 7 days of trial, was to claim that my client had violated a court order and that they had a cause of action under Section 36.02A, and that was the first time that they were claiming that. Our response was somewhat immediate. We filed special exceptions, which were overruled. We filed a plea in abatement, which was overruled. The plaintiff has taken the position on appeal that this is all much ado about nothing. I think not. One of the issues that is presented by the Family Code is that if someone is accused of violating a court order, they're entitled to know what court order they're supposed to be violating, and they're supposed to be given an opportunity to cure that violation. My client...
Considering this parental kidnapping took place over a period of 7 years, is there any doubt what the offense was and how grievous it was?
There is no question about the grievousness of the offense committed by the father. But what I am saying, Your Honor, is that if my client is accused of directly violating a court order, and we contend that she did not, then she's entitled to know what court order she's accused of violating.
Did she know who was to have custody of the children?
By that time, I think she probably did, yes, sir.
Did she ever pick up the phone and call to rectify that problem?
No question that she did not. The evidence is that the children came with their father on two occasions unannounced, once in December of 1983, the second time in November of 1985, and no, my client did not pick up the phone.
Is it stipulated that this is an epidemic problem of national proportion, parental kidnapping?
I don't know if it's of epidemic proportion, Your Honor, but it is something that is of concern, and it needs to be of concern. But again, I am not so jaded from the years I've been practicing law as to think that people will not respond and try to cure something if they are told that they are violating a court order. And that's a problem that carried through from the time that their petition was amended until the time that this case went to the jury.
Counsel, I don't think you're saying what I just thought I heard you say. There's evidence that apparently the jury found that she was not only aware of but aided in the abduction initially. That she was, of course, aware of the abduction over a 7-year period and apparently was aware of the court's custody orders initially in this case before the abduction and aware of them throughout the 7-year period of the absence of the children from their mother, who was the court-ordered legal custodian of those children. And you're saying that she was not aware during all this time that she was violating the court's order?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and I beg to differ on one aspect of what you said, and that is that there is absolutely no evidence that my client ever received any notice, real, actual, or imagined, of the temporary restraining order that was issued on February 1st of 1982. She received no notice whatsoever of any kind of court order until after the abduction had already taken place by the children's father. She was not named as a party to the action until March 3rd of 1982. And when the final decree of divorce was entered in April of 1982, that part of the case was severed out.
But 1983, the children visited in her home.
That is correct.
In 1985, the children visited in her home.
That also is correct.
During the course of those 7 years, she was in occasional, if not regular, communication with the father, wherever he was and the children were, by telephone. Probably. It's a strong inference that she was aware of his whereabouts, I would say. At least the jury apparently concluded that. By that time, by 1983, she did have notice that there was a court order, did she not?
I think the record would support that, yes, sir.
So from 1983 to 1989, at least, six-year period of abduction. Of course, the trial was held before the children were found and returned to the mother. She was aware that there was a court order.
I think it's fair to state that she knew that the mother was a custodial parent.
Even if she were not initially aware, she was at that time.
That's correct, Your Honor. The question then is whether or not...
But she still continued to cooperate in this abduction for that period of time.
I disagree with that,
Your
Honor.
She gave no notice to anyone. She knew that they were abducted. She knew there was a court order. She gave no notice to anyone when the children were in her home on two occasions at least, and she was in occasional, if not regular, communication with them.
How soon did the children come back after the jury came in with this verdict? How long did it take to get them back after this case was tried?
I believe the children were found, and my memory may not be perfect, but I believe that they were found in January of 1989.
And when was this case tried?
The case was tried in December of 1988.
So within a month, then the children were back home.
That is correct.
Could we assume that if the case had been tried 5 years earlier, the children would have been home 5 years earlier?
I can't speculate on that. That's certainly possible. The key point with respect to this notice of violation of a court order, and I want to get back to it, the jury found interference with child custody. There was a very broad submission which we objected to, which allowed a recovery for interference with child custody if my client either directly violated a court order under 36.02A or aided or assisted in a violation of a court order under 36.02C. There was no breakout. So I cannot tell this court that the jury found one or the other. And the problem with respect to the court order issue was one that was present once they filed the amended pleading. It arose in the voir dire presentation by opposing counsel because they claimed, among other things, that an oral pronouncement, which was advisory in nature from the bench at a contempt hearing on March 11 of 1982, was a court order. Since we had not received notice of what court order we were supposed to be violating, one of the things that we did was request instructions, and we objected to the charge because the charge did not delineate what court order they were talking about. Certainly, it could not be a court order we had no notice of. Now, the San Antonio Court of Appeals cleared it up somewhat because what they said is that the oral pronouncement from the bench from Judge Chapa on March 11th was not a court order. Yet that is what the petitioner argued throughout this case. And the first question back from the jury was for the trial judge to explain to them what Judge Chapa meant when he was talking about court orders and that he would not order, but that he would advise at that March 11, 1982 hearing. It seems to me that if someone is going to be accused of violating a court order, under this statute, they ought to be given the opportunity to know what it is they've done and what they can do, and then they know at that point what they can do to try to cure it. My client never had that opportunity. and it's my position that she never violated a court order. Both Section 700 of the Restatement and Chapter 36 of the Family Code direct their attention to matters which are acts of commission and not acts of omission, such as not picking up the phone and calling the police. There is simply no duty to do so.
Counsel, would you concede that abduction is a continuing offense during the period of abduction?
It is with respect to the father.
Or anyone who cooperates with him in that abduction?
Anyone who aids or assists, as that term is used within the term of the statute. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. John Newell, Senate rebuttal argument of four petitioners.
May it please this honorable court, Justice Heck, Justice Gonzalez, you've raised some questions about whether or not this particular type of action can carry with it a negligent feature. And I think without a doubt, under the facts of this case, it certainly can. This was not the first abduction of these children. This was the third abduction of these children. After the first abduction, my client retained the return of her children from Ms. Opal Wyrick. That's where the children were taken. After the second abduction, approximately 2 weeks before the third abduction, my client once again found out that the children were taken to Opal Wyrick. In the third abduction, there was evidence in the record that not only did Opal Wyrick on each one of these occasions buy clothes for the children, make loans to the son, but all the furniture that was lifted out of the house ended up in Opal Wyrick's barn. Now, I think there's a limit as to how far someone can stick their head in the sand and just say, I just plain don't care.
Well, that seems to cut against you. It seems like that is all the more evidence of intent on the part of Opal to really mean to do this.
Well, I think you could read it either way, and I think the jury read it either way on the interference with the custody of the child. This was a situation, Your Honor, where we played a videotape of Opal Wyrick's deposition. When she was asked on one of these meetings, how is it that you got in touch with, because they denied all the way through the whole trial, pre-trial, all the way along, they didn't know where the children were. The question was asked on the video deposition, how is it the two of you got together up there in Fredericksburg? And her response was, I called him. No, he called me. Now, the jury was entitled to see and watch that lady and determine whether or not she was a credible person. The jury was entitled to look at her and see whether or not she just plain didn't care, didn't exercise ordinary care. The evidence is certainly circumstantial from Connie Wyrick, who was a party to the case, who told my client that Opal Wyrick and the sister of Noah Wyrick took them to the airport. The evidence could be taken either way on that. But there's no doubt that she stood up in the courtroom through her counsel when the question was asked, if you find out where they are, will you tell the court, will you tell the mother of these children? And she indicated that she would. She can assume a duty. And after she assumes that responsibility, she can perform it negligently. So there's all species of negligent conduct throughout this 7-year period that led up to the final culmination of the verdict.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.